So I was going to start by reviewing a little bit what I said yesterday. I guess some things I went through too quickly. So the idea was to use the example of Chern Simons, which is, I guess, much easier to understand, to reproduce the same features as what we want to see for the super Yang mills. So the Chern Simons action, just to, I'm going to now do more carefully to show how the superparticle reproduces the Chern Simons. I skipped that important step, so I want to now do it. So here you have gauge invariances associated with the p mu and the p squared, and of course they're related because if you shift L by p, you have this same constraint. But I'm going to treat them as independent, then you'll have a ghost for ghost. So after you gauge fix, so the gauge fixing condition will be E equals 1 and L mu equals 0. Then you get the ghost coming from this gauge fixing, and a ghost coming from the L mu gauge fixing. Then you also get the ghost per ghost, which we'll see. It's easy to see if you write down the BRST operator. So this is just the ghost times this constraint, and then you get the other ghost times the other constraint. And then now you see there's a gauge invariance of these ghosts. So if you shift the ghosts appropriately, so you see that this term shifts the C ghost by a constant, and this ghost shifts C mu by something proportional to P mu. So if you do it correctly, they cancel. So that's just the usual ghost for ghost. So of course you also need to, so this is a BRST operator associated with this gauge fixing. And now you can see that if I do a similarity transformation, where R is defined to be C B mu P mu, then you can see that this term, the change of this term is just going to cancel this piece here, and the change of this term is just going to cancel this piece here. So this is just going to give you C mu P mu minus gamma B. And now this is the usual topological term. So as soon as you have this quartet mechanism where these fields don't appear anywhere else in the BRST operator, it means that the cohomology is independent of those fields. So you can go ahead and use Q equals, so if I call this the new Q, then we can use this BRST operator and you have fields which only depend on C mu and X. And this, has an expansion up to three C's and the action phi q phi plus 2/3 phi cubed is just the usual Chern-Simons action, including the anti-field. Okay, so this is more or less straightforward, even though maybe you've never seen it before. So are there any questions about this? Okay, so now we want to imitate this for the superparticle. So maybe there's one more thing I want to do before I do the superparticle, which will be useful. I don't have to stop when I do the superparticle. So this was what was called a pure spinner in 10 dimensions. And I told you lambda has 11 independent complex components. So lambda is in so this has 10 complex components, and this has one. And there are some convenient ways to parameterize lambda. So as I already mentioned, if I use the usual plus-minus notation, so there are 32 possible choices. If you have an odd number of plus signs, that tells you it's a chiral spinner. And if all of them are in the plus direction, And it's easy to see that it satisfies this constraint, just because you think of each plus here as having plus 1/2 u1 charge. So there's a u1 of this u5. This has u1 charge plus 5/2. So if I have two of them, it obviously has u1 charge plus 5. So this gamma m always has u1 charge plus 1 or minus 1. So it's clear that this is always going to give you just something proportional to a 5 form. That's the only way to get something of u1 charge plus 5. So this is an example. If this is the only non-vanishing component of lambda, it's a pure spinner. And you can get other ones by doing a Lorentz rotation. So let me call this lambda plus. So under u5, a 16-component spinner of SO10 splits up into a 1, a 10, and a 5. I guess I'll call it 5 bar. So the 10 turn out to be independent of this. So you can choose them to be, let me call them lambda AB. Let me put it down here. So A is 1 to 5. In the fundamental of U5, so this is a 10 of U5. And the other one will be lambda with an up index. Now, if you do a Lorentz transformation of this, turns out there are 10 Lorentz transformations which change this into something new. So these in general will be independent. So let me call them UAB. Whereas the last one will be determined. So if you do if the U's are finite, not just infinitesimal, you'll get terms which are quadratic in U when you do the Lorentz transformation. And it turns out they're proportional to 1 over lambda plus. So this is one way to parameterize the 16 components of a pure spinner. And it assumes, obviously, that lambda plus is non-vanishing. Okay, so you start with lambda plus non-vanishing as being the only non-zero component. And then you can get to these other solutions just by doing a Lorentz transformation. Okay, so that's one way to parameterize it. It clearly has 11 independent components. There's another way to do it in SO8 notation, which will be useful for the superparticle, which is I split lambda alpha into lambda A and lambda A dot, where these are the SO8 indices. So A equals 1 to 8. And also A dot equals 1 to 8. So this is just the gamma plus part of lambda. And this is the gamma minus part. Now, if you look at this constraint, you can see that lambda A must satisfy lambda A equals 0. So it's a null SO8 chiral spinner. So that just happens if you make this plus. Now, this one also has to be null, but it's actually more constrained because also the transverse components have to be null. And what you can show is that it has to be related to lambda A by contraction with an SO8 vector. Now, it turns out that only 4 of these 8 components contribute. So what happens is, if you break SO8 down to U4, which you can think of as a light cone version of breaking this SO10 down to U5, the vector, so if I have an SO8 vector, let's call it J, it splits up into a 4 and 4 bar. That's what I'm calling it J. Under this U4. That means that the chiral spinner, or one of the spinners, has to split up into a 1, 6, and 1. And A bar will also split up into a 4 and 4 bar. So actually, you can make it even more refined. If you think of U4 as being SU4 times U1, you find that the U1 charges of the vector are correlated with the SU4. So the 4 has U1 charge plus 1. The 4 bar has U1 charge minus 1. But actually, right. This 1 would have U1 charge 2. 6 would have U1 charge 0. Sorry, it's getting smaller. Minus 2. And this one has the opposite. It's minus 1 and plus 1. So these, of course, are different representations of SO8. And you can see that, in fact, they have different U1 charges. So it's easy to work this out just by going through the gamma matrix language. So are there any questions about that? Say it again. Ah, thank you. Okay. Is there any questions? So any kind of question is useful, because probably other people have the same question. Okay, so I didn't say it. I should have said it. So this obviously has 7 independent components because of the constraint. And this naively looks like it has 8 because HJ naively has 8 components. But as I said, when you do this split, HJ actually only 4 of them contribute. So that's how the 11 split up under SO8. Okay, so now let's go to the superparticles. So we start with the same action we had before, Brink and Schwartz. And we write it in the form that was first done by Siegel, introducing a conjugate momentum to theta. And now you can see that it's very similar to this action here. You have the p squared constraint, but instead of p mu, it's d alpha. So you might think, well, d alpha and p squared are unrelated. But in fact, they are related, not in such a simple way as p mu and p squared, but they're related in a way that we'll see soon. Now, d alpha, as I mentioned yesterday, so p mu and p squared are, of course, all abelian constraints, which means all first class. D alpha has a first class and a second class piece. That just means that if I commute d alpha with d beta, so just to remind you, d alpha is equal to p alpha plus 1/2. So if I commute this anti-commutator, you just get Pm. And then because p squared is 0, that means, so let's say, suppose p is in the just plus direction, non-0, and all the other components are 0. Then it's easy to see this is just going to be gamma minus. Now, gamma minus is a matrix which only has non-zero components in one corner here. So that tells you that if you take d's from this corner, they're abelian. So half of first class and half of second class. So the ones in this corner are going to give you the second class too. Okay, that's in this Lorentz frame, but of course I can go to any other Lorentz frame. Nothing's going to change. Okay, so normally, if you have first-class constraints, it's trivial to gauge fix and get BRST operator. But if you try to do that with second-class constraints, normally the BRST operator you would guess is going to be not nilpotent. Now, in this case, the fact that you're going to end up with pure spinners is going to compensate the fact that you have second-class constraints. So let's see how that happens. So the first thing we're going to do, part of these are first-class constraints, and you can actually figure out in a Lorentz covariant way which ones are first class by looking at p slash d. So if you take the anticommutator of this with itself, you in general will get gamma m alpha beta pm times p squared. So that's obviously first class because p squared vanishes using the other constraint. So the anticommutator is proportional to constraint. Now, to be more specific, let me choose these to be, there's naively 16, but only 8 are independent. So let me choose them to be in that direction. So this just gives you p plus times delta AB. So I'll choose these to gauge fix some of the f's to 0. So I'm not going to use them to gauge fix theta. That would be going to light cone gauge. I'm going to choose them to gauge fix f8 to 0. So gauge so if you like gamma plus. So half of the f's I can gauge to 0. OK, so that's going to give me this action. So I'll also gauge E equals 1. So I get the usual EC ghost, fermionic ghost from that gauge fixing, and I get 8 bosonic ghosts from the gauge fixing of this. And I still have these second class constraints left over. And I have to do something with them. Now it turns out the second class constraints are simple. They apply dA dot dB dot equals delta A dot B dot times P plus. It's non-vanishing, the second class. But it's very simple. I can turn the 8 second class constraints into 4 first class by choosing some complex combination. So now how am I going to choose that combination? What I'm going to do is I'm going to break the SO8 to U4. So one thing I should have said from the beginning, I don't know, this is of course a Lorentz covariant action. The final point is also going to be Lorentz covariant. I don't know how to go from one to the other in a manifestly Lorentz covariant way. So that hasn't been done, and that's the unfortunate thing about the proof. And that will cause some problems later, but at least for the moment, let me not require that my gauge fixing procedure is Lorentz covariant. So I'm going to break this SO8, I guess I've already broken SO10 down to SO8, by choosing a component of essentially doing this split here. I'm going to break the SO8 down to SU4 times U1, and that's going to split the A into a 1, 6, and 1. And I'm going to choose one of those. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write to split these 8 bosonic ghosts into an SO8 pure spinner, which is this lambda A here, which is null, and one other component. So this, of course, has 8 components, this has 7, this has 1. And I'm just going to choose the direction. So this plus will denote this index here, and the minus will denote that index there. Okay, I should say that this gauge fixing is described in a, I can find the HEP number. So it's not in the ICTP notes. It was done more recently. People are interested. OK, so why have I done this? The idea is that now I'm going to use this lambda A, which is a null spinner, to choose how I break the SO8 down to U4. Okay, so I defined this, and now I'm going to gauge fix for choose. So 4 of these can be chosen to be first class constraints, and the choice I'm going to make is lambda sigma j A dot A dot. These will be my first class constraints. So I use this SO8, now SO8 pure spinner, to break my 8 second class constraints into this set of 4 first class. So there are only 4 of these for the same reason there are only 4 of these here. So now I can use this to gauge fix the rest of the F to 0. So now I get an action which is going to be now here I'm going to split my gamma into gamma lambda. So I'll write this as gamma tilde. And then I also have my ghosts coming from this cage fixing here. So I have ghosts associated with these first class constraints. Let me just, for notation, let me call them H and G. So these are bosonic ghosts because these are fermionic constraints. And I have four of them. So although I use this notation J, you have to remember it's only four of them contribute. Okay, now at this point, I should have already told you what the BRST operator was here. So at this point, I have a nilpotent BRST operator, but of course, it doesn't yet involve these second-class constraints. So at this point, the BRST operator was so I'll explain where these terms come from. So this is, of course, the ghost coming from gauge fixing E equal 1. These are the ghosts coming from gauge fixing FA equals 0. And this is the ghost-ghost-anti-ghost term coming from the fact that it's not abelian, it's a non-abelian. So after doing this, this term is going to split up into the term gamma tilde. So it's just the P slash D in the plus direction. Maybe I should have written it like this. Just picks one component, the component coming from this split, from this component here. And then you have the rest of it. Now gamma squared, gamma A squared, is of course non-zero, but when you decompose it like this, it implies that gamma A squared, because lambda A squared is zero, by definition, is going to be 2 lambda, if I write it in this notation, lambda minus gamma tilde, or if you like, lambda plus. So it chooses one component, the component that's contracted when you take gamma A, gamma A. So if gamma tilde was this component, lambda plus would be this component. Okay. So this term in the BRST operator becomes minus gamma tilde lambda plus B over 2. Okay, then finally you had the term coming from the from these first class constraints. So that's HJ, these four ghosts. Remember, there's only four of these. Contracted with lambda A. Okay, so this is, of course, nilpotent because, well, the construction is standard gauge fixing. I'm just using first class constraints. Okay, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to combine these two terms into just lambda alpha d alpha. So what you do, what you can see is that when I do this composition here, this decomposition, if this hj is precisely this hj, actually it's hj plus the term pj here, this becomes So we have this lambda alpha d alpha comes from these two terms. Essentially the same construction as here, actually. This h is going to be, if you do it carefully, it's hj plus pj. So this term coming from here. So that gives you lambda alpha. So lambda alpha, lambda a, hj plus pj, gamma. So this is the definition of lambda a dot. And this is clearly a null, a pure spinner. So you can easily check that this is nilpotent. And now we're going to do the same thing as before. We do a similarity transformation. So if I define e to the minus r, q e to the r, where r is equal to c t slash b plus over lambda plus, then you can see that, for example, this term here, when you commute it with this, will get rid of this term. This term here, when you commute it with this, will get rid of this term. That's not so easy to see, but if you take the anticommutator of d alpha with p slash d, it's easy to show this is proportional to p squared delta alpha beta. So that's what tells you that anticommutator of this with this is going to kill this thing. Okay, so this is just equal to lambda alpha d alpha. Okay, so we've gotten, okay, no, oh, sorry, plus, of course, this term here. So we haven't gotten rid of this term. So this plays the same role as the term minus gamma b there. So these, if you think of lambda plus as being non-zero, and p plus obviously as being non-zero, then this tells you that b and gamma tilde decouple. So you can ignore these terms. And this, of course, is just going to give you the lambda alpha dot w alpha kinetic term in the action. So we've gotten to the point where the action is manifestly covariant. So the end result is manifestly covariant. The BRST operator is manifestly covariant. Well, after you drop this. And now we can follow the same rules as we did for Chern-Simon. So now Q is equal to lambda alpha d alpha. Phi is now a function of lambda x and theta. And now you have a similar expansion, but now it's going to be super. And of course, the result is going to give you super angular. Okay, so are there any questions? Yeah, okay, so. Yeah, so there's a bit of a fudge. So you're right. So that's right. So if lambda plus is non-zero, then this doesn't work. But the general construction is it's almost correct. Okay, so I mean it's certainly a justification for using this. Now what happens, there's another point which follows nicely from this construction, is that if you start with the B ghost and do this similarity transformation, then you'll see the B ghost goes to B plus P slash D over. So the B ghost in the pure spinner formalism will have this type of term, as compared in Chern-Simons, where the B ghost, after you do the similarity transformation, remember, goes to B plus B mu P. So the B ghost becomes non-conventional in this construction. And we'll see that, of course, when we do this, the string case also. So this derivation at least shows where the subtleties are going to appear. when you do the stream. Okay. But this is the best that has been done, I think, for showing how to go from. So there are other ways of getting to the superparticle action by gauge fixing, but I think they're all uglier than this one. So I don't know if there's I suspect there is no nice way. Yeah, is there any other question? The last one is this one here. That's that one there, lambda alpha b alpha. So I've done the similarity transformation. So the similarity transformation, of course, doesn't affect the action. The unitary transformation, it won't affect the action. It's a free action. So I'm free to do the similarity transformation. It's just a field redefinition. That's right. That's right. Yeah, so if I do the field redefinition, it's just going to change x to x prime. So I'm just going to remove the prime. I don't know if that's. I don't know if I'm answering your question or not, but yeah, it's because it's a unitary transformation. Yeah, so you don't really drop it. You say that that term enforces it, that B and that these terms don't contribute to the cohomology, so I can ignore it. It will turn out, so I will get there later, that when you try to describe the GSO minus sector, you will need that. So it's not something you should just throw away. You should remember that it's there. Okay, but. But in the same way as it's there for the Chern-Simon, okay? So we'll see that later. Yeah, so in the same sense as I threw this out. But I didn't throw it out. What it means is that it's like going the opposite procedure of adding non-minimal fields. So adding non-minimal fields means adding these terms to the action, adding BC and beta gamma to the action, and modifying the BRST operator in this way. And that does nothing. Of course, I can also go in the opposite direction if it really does nothing. So that's all I'm doing. How do I see the question? Oh, I'm not careful with eyes, but if I were careful, so you're asking about reality conditions. Yeah, let me call it similarity transformation, not say the word unitary. So it certainly preserves OPU. Okay, what's being shown? Okay, so we started with Brink-Schwarz superparticle action. And what I've shown is that this endpoint reproduces the desired action. The desired action is, you know, these fields and this superangular action. So the endpoint is correct. What I'm trying to do is connect the endpoint to the Brink-Schwarz action. If you don't like the Brink-Schwarz action, I don't mind if you throw away the Brink-Schwarz action. But certainly the endpoint I want to keep. So I'm just trying to justify. So if you want to say that pure spin of formalism is not covariant quantization of Brink-Schwarz, I have no objection. But I would say it's better than Green-Schwarz, so we don't need Green-Schwarz anymore. But this at least is the best way I have seen to connect it. So obviously, it gives you more confidence that you can connect it with something which is understood in some sense. And of course, there are many features of Green-Schwarz which work very nicely, and you would like to at least see, once somebody gives you Green-Schwarz, how to do it in this. And it certainly gives you the tools to do that. But I wouldn't call this rigorous. So your kind of question is, what kind of rigor is there? And I would say zero, but I'm not. Yeah. You can try, but I don't care, because it's the end point I like. I don't care about the beginning. If you make it rigorous, you've proved that the beginning is correct, but who cares? Okay, so, I mean, for pedagogical reasons, obviously, it's useful, but if I could make it more rigorous, I would. And if you can make it more rigorous, please do, but I'm not going to worry about it right now. Okay, so the other... Okay, so now we want to go to the string. So, of course, particle is nice, but as I said, if you can't do the particle, you certainly can't do the string. So, what I claim is you can now do the string. Okay, so I certainly don't need transcendental. That's all I said. So if I forget to say, of course, this endpoint that I mentioned is, of course, just one point. You can reproduce super-angular string field theory action. Of course, there are many other things you can do with this, like compute scattering amplitude, that you can't do using Green-Schwarz. So Pierre will talk tomorrow about using this formalism to compute loop amplitudes and prove non-renormalization theorem. So I won't get to loop amplitudes, but at least I'll show how to compute tree amplitudes. And also, Luca will talk on Monday about applications for ADS. So, of course, Green-Schwarz you can use to describe classical strings in ADS 5 times S5, but, of course, we want to quantize. Okay, so string is going to be very similar. So I'll just do the flat background here. So we can do heterotic or type 1 or type 2. You take your pick. So here I'll do type 2. So of course I could do the same non-rigorous derivation for the superstring. So that's in that paper that I referenced, that paper there. But if you don't like the argument for the superparticle, you also won't like it for the string. So it has the same amount of rigor. Okay, so this type of action for lambda, you might say, well, it's not really a free action because lambda is constrained. So I just erased, of course, you can write lambda in terms of unconstrained parameters, not in a covariant way. But there is a well-defined way to work with these kinds of variables, which are called curved beta gamma systems. So beta gamma because they're bosonic, and curved because of they have this kind of constraint. So Nikita, when he arrives, I think in the third week, he'll give a lecture about beta gamma systems. So I won't talk about how to work with them. I'll just tell you how to compute OPEs. Okay, so Q, of course, is going to be, now you have left moving and right moving variables. So D alpha. So this was worked out by Warren in 86. It's just a superstring version of what I did before for the particle. And d hat is the same thing with just all the variables replaced by hat. And now it's easy to show that they said so. These are free fields. It's easy to compute OPEs, at least for this sector. I'll say about the lambda sector in a second. So what you find is that d alpha of y with d beta of z goes like so pi m is the supersymmetric version of dx. And you can also, of course, compute d alpha with pi m. So they have very simple OPEs. And now the lambda sector. So my vertex operators will depend on these fields, and I have to compute correlation functions. So I need to know the OPEs of the lambdas. Now this has a gauge invariance, which is delta W alpha. So because of the constraint, lambda gamma lambda equals zero, if you shift W by this amount, you can see that it decouples. So we're going to enforce this gauge invariance by saying that W only appears in gauge invariant combinations. Gauge invariant. So the Lorentz invariant combinations are the Lorentz current. The ghost current and stress tensor. And now one can ask, what are the OPEs of these objects? So with lambda, it's clear what the OPEs are. NMN is just going to rotate it like a spinner. So it just has a simple pole. J will also just have a simple pole. T, it will transform like a primary field. But now you can ask, what are the OPEs of these with themselves? And that's more interesting, because they're essential charges. And I'm not going to compute them for you here, but there are various ways to compute them. One way is to just write these in terms of unconstrained fields and compute the OPEs. So you get the standard term, which is Katsumudi algebra, so it's just proportional to n. This is just SO91 Lorentz currents. But then you get a central charge, which is going to be k over y minus e squared times eta n p eta. And k, when you compute it, turns out to be minus 3. Kind of strange. So it has level minus 3. You can compute T with N, you find that these are primary fields. T with J is not the primary field. So T with J goes like, it turns out to be minus 8 over Z squared. And then, of course, you have the usual term Gj over it. Now, T with T you can guess there are 11 of these, so it's going there. Dimension conformal weight zero object, so you just get, thanks. Plus the usual. You could also compute J ghost with J ghost. That's really, I think, the one that at least I don't understand the physical meaning of. But these turn out to have physical significance. So, of course, this tells you that the total central charge is zero, because contribution from here, of course, gives you 10. Contribution from here gives you minus 32. And I made a mistake. Oh, sorry, this is C over 2. Maybe I should write it as 22 over 2. So you get the central charge contribution from here, from plus 22. Because you have 11 pairs of these 0, 1 objects. So the total central charge is 0. This minus 3 we'll get to in a second. That has to do with the level of the Lorentz algebra. And this has to do with the ghost number anomaly. So, okay, so we'll explain those things. So are there any questions? Thank you. Okay, so we want to do now physical states. We have the BRC operator. Let me do just for open string. For open string, we want vertex operators to be ghost number one. So in general, they will have at least a lambda in them. So if you want to do massless, essentially we've already done it for the superparticle. So this, of course, describes super Yang Mills. So it only depends on the zero modes, like the superparticle, because unlike in bosonic string theory, there's no tachyon. So the massless fields only depend on the zero mode. You can also do the first massive level if you want. It's more complicated because you have all these possibilities. You could also have a term d lambda. So I just wrote down every conformal weight plus one object I can think of. I guess I could also put j ghost here. And now you ask, what does it mean that this is in the cohomology? So qv is equal to zero and not q of something. And it was shown together with Osvaldo Chandia that this describes a massive spin tumult. Okay, so you can go further and compute the partition function together with Isaka, Yuri Isaka, who's here, Everaldo Arroyo, and Nikith and Nekrasov. We showed the partition function gives the right answer up to the fifth mass level, okay? Just by computing the partition function in terms of these three fields. Okay, so if we're closed, in a flat background, it's just going to be the square. And I think Luca will talk about this when he talks about ADS, right? So this is going to describe supergravity. So I didn't say it, but if you're doing type 2A, these have different chirality. If you're doing type 2B, they have the same chirality. Okay, so are there any questions about that? Okay, so the next thing is, of course, to compute scattering amplitudes. So here I'll just do tree amplitudes because Pierre will talk about loops tomorrow. So the easiest one is, of course, the 3-point. I've already told you how to do that for the massless case because I have three unintegrated vertex operators. When these are on shell, this is just the cubic term in the open string field theory action. So if you expand this out, you can see, for example, that the term with five thetas define this to be 1, then you're looking for the term here with 5 thetas. And if you use the expansion that I gave you before, that A alpha starts out as the gluon times theta plus the gluino times theta squared plus the field strength times theta cubed, then it's easy to see this just gives you the usual cubic action. So the 3-point works out very easily. If you want to do n-point tree amplitude, you have three unintegrated ones. And then you need to have n minus 3 integrated ones. So I'll tell you what this u is in a second. So we're choosing a reparameterization. So this is not... this is done in the reparameterization gauge where the B ghosts are all sewn into the vertex operator. So in about 10 minutes, I'll tell you how to do the B with B ghosts. But this is the most convenient gauge to compute the amplitude. So what is U? So let me do it just for the massless case. So normally, of course, you get the integrated one by just pulling a C ghost off the unintegrated one. Here we don't have a C ghost. So we're going to use an inverse procedure. We're going to say that there's a descent procedure for the unintegrated and integrated vertex operator, which is if you take Q on the integrated one, or on the integrand of the integrated one, you get the total derivative. And it's just the total derivative of the unintegrated one. So this is a cohomology problem. It's clear that Q of this thing is zero. So now, because it's conformal weight one, you know the cohomology has to be non-trivial. So it's just a question of finding this U that satisfies it. And what you find is for the massless case, U is related to these field strengths, which are built out of A alpha. So I told you before that A alpha starts at A slash theta. AM starts with the gluon. W alpha, which you can write as EM A beta minus so this combination of A alpha and AM gives you a field strength, which starts out as the gluino. And FMN starts out with the field strength of the gluon. So these are just the super fields you get that I described yesterday. And the integrated vertex operator, like in RNS, depends not just on the gauge field, but also on the field strength. Now, if you work out what this is for the gluon, suppose I'm just looking at the gluon. So the gluon, let me turn off the gluino and suppose that I'm looking at a gluon with momentum k. Then you find that this has a structure dxm, so am e to the ik dot x. Dxm. And then you get, that comes from here because pi m has a dxm in it. Then you get the term from here, which is P alpha KM. You get this structure. So where does this K come from? So if you expand W, the first term is the gluino, the second term is the field strength. So it's Km gluino times contracted with the... So this is the field strength, which appears here because of this term. So D alpha has a term with D in it. And then W alpha, the term linear in theta, gives you this contribution, the vertex operator. And obviously, this contribution comes from FMN. And then there are terms which are higher order in theta. So for example, there are all kinds of terms here, quadratic in theta, et cetera. So if you ignore these terms which are higher order in theta, this has the same structure as the vertex operator in RNS, where this object here in RNS is psi m psi n. Now, if you compute the level of n, we computed it's minus 3. If you compute the level of this, it turns out to be plus 4. And the level of psi m psi n is plus 1. So you see, this level of this n is actually determined if you want the vertex operator to have the same OPEs as in RNS. So this is the vertex operator for the gluon. Now, suppose I do this computation where I only have gluons. I don't have any gluinos. Then just because of conservation of the number of thetas, essentially, you can ignore these terms never contribute to the scattering amplitude. It's because there are no p's available to absorb these thetas. So it's very simple to prove for endpoint amplitudes that this reproduces the endpoint free amplitudes. For external Navier-Schwartz states, that this reproduces the RNS amplitude. So that was first shown with Balema. Now, once you have fermions, it's much more complicated because now these terms will start to couple. So it's not at all obvious to show if you have arbitrary endpoint amplitudes that it agrees if you include the fermions. Okay, but this formalism turns out, of course, it's space-time supersymmetric. So knowing the boson amplitude pretty much guarantees you'll get the fermions right. And if you didn't get it right, I would trust this more than I would trust RNS in any case. Okay, so are there any questions? Okay, so suppose we want to do this correlation function. How do we do it? Okay, so obviously the x's and thetas we know how to do. Now we have a bunch of n's and lambdas, and maybe we have some other j's, but let's suppose we just have n's and lambdas. So the n's are conformal weight one objects. So the first thing we do is use their OPEs with themselves and with the lambdas to write this in terms of an expression which just involves lambdas, maybe d lambdas. But we've gotten rid of all the n's using their OPEs. And now here, once we don't have any conjugates to lambdas, only the zero modes contribute, and we fall back to this formula. Exact means we know the poles. You're asking for the regular terms? So you can work it out. It's a mess. No. So n is a conformal weight one object. So if we take it out to infinity, it has to vanish. So only the poles contribute. When we do loop amplitudes, there are zero modes associated with this, and you have to integrate out those zero modes. But again, those zero modes are also easy to take care of because they're just zero modes. Okay, so let me say something. So these are things which work nicely and easily. And of course, the next thing is to do loop amplitudes. And the first thing you have to do for loop amplitudes is describe the B-ghost. So if you want to do loop amplitudes, then naively, you have to put in the term which is B to 3g minus 3. And now there's no more. Let's suppose g is not equal to 1. So in bosonic string theory, this would be the correlation function you'd have to compute. So it's a cohomology question. If there exists a b satisfying, it's clear q commutes with t. So the question is, can you write T as the anti-commutator of Q with something? And it turns out that there is an answer, and it's related to this discussion we just had with the superparticle, which is there's another term, N d theta. So you pick a component of this, and you divide by lambda plus. And it's not difficult to show in the same way as we did for the superparticle that lambda alpha d alpha. Remember, I showed you the commutator of this is just, it's lambda beta t squared. So if you do this for the string, this just becomes t. And if you divide by lambda plus, then you can see that this formally satisfies Q with B as T. But of course, this doesn't make sense when lambda plus is 0. And now we're really going to compute things, so we need to be rigorous. So the way to do that is to introduce these non-minimal variables, and that's what Pierre will talk about. So I mentioned them briefly yesterday. I think he will talk about them in more detail. You introduce non-minimal variables. And now you contract these indices here. So this object here still satisfies Q with B is T, just because lambda bar doesn't transform under Q. But now, if I really want to introduce these variables, I have to modify Q. So now I'm looking for lambda alpha d alpha plus this additional term, which was W alpha alpha. Now I'm trying to solve a harder problem. I want to compute, find a B whose anticommutator with this object is T. Now this no longer works because lambda bar does not commute with W bar. And it turns out you have to add more terms. So I'm sure he will talk about it. The last term has four powers of lambda, lambda bar in the denominator, but then it stops. So if it was infinite, you'd be in trouble. It turns out to stop. So we can use this B ghost if we introduce the non-minimal variables and compute this. Okay, so we have to do some regularization. I already mentioned a regularization that you need to do just to get the tree amplitude involving this I introduced this object here. So if you want to compute this and regularize the 0 over 0s, you have to put in n. It turns out for tree amplitudes, this is enough. If you want to do loop amplitudes, you also have divergence associated with the 0 modes of the w's, of the conjugates to lambdas, so you have to modify n. It gets messier, but in principle, things still work. Now, there's one more thing that has to be regularized that Costas mentioned earlier. You also have possible problems when lambda goes to 0. You also have to add terms in n which solve that. So up to two loops, so as you'll see, you can compute four-point amplitudes explicitly up to two loops without worrying about the problems when lambda, lambda bar goes to 0. If you go beyond two loops, there are certain amplitudes will start to cause problems. And those haven't been computed explicitly. So cause problems just means you have to worry about the poles here. There are certain amplitudes you can compute above two loops, which Pierre will talk about, which you can compute because these poles don't cause problems, and those lead to non-renormalization theorems. And that's something that's been only done using this formula. Okay, so that's the discussion of tree amplitudes and the beginning of loop amplitudes, but Pierre will talk about that tomorrow. Are there any questions about this? Okay, so in the last 20 minutes, I want to discuss GSO minus sector, which was also discussed in this paper I gave to you before, this reference of the 2007 paper. And do I have anything there I want? So as we've seen, in the GSO plus sector for bosons, it's easy to relate to RNS. I mean, I almost showed you what the map was from here's the massless vertex operator. In the Ramon sector, even GSO plus, it's very difficult to relate them. Now, if you know anything about the Ramon sector in RNS language, it's clear it's going to be difficult because here you don't have pictures. Everything is only in one picture. Whereas in RNS, as soon as you have Ramon states, you have different possibilities for the vertex operators. And you need to include the different possibilities, otherwise the amplitude will vanish. So you need to include different pictures. That's essentially also the problem in constructing open superstring field theory in the Ramon sector. You have to worry about these two different pictures. Now, here we only have one picture, so it's clear that there's no way to map this to RNS. If there was, you would only need one picture in RNS. Okay, now you can do the opposite. You can ask, well, what about the GSO minus sector in RNS? There I only have one picture. Suppose I tried to do the GSO minus sector in this case. Well, it'll turn out when you try to do that in this case, even for the bosons, you'll find you need more than one picture. And you also need spin fields, etc. So let me say why you need spin fields. It's obvious when you think about it, but maybe not many people have thought about it. So if you think of the, let's do in RNS, if I think of theta alpha in RNS, so Q alpha in RNS is going to be something like e to the minus pi over 2 sigma alpha. And theta alpha in RNS is going to be something like, so these are the same phis that Barton introduced in the morning that come from bosonizing the beta gamma system. And these are the spin fields constructed from the psis. So this is Friedan-Martinek-Shankly. Now, when you take the OPE of this with something which is GSO minus, so for example, the tachyon is C e to the minus phi e to the ik dot x, then you see that this has square root cuts. So that means if you have a state in the GSO minus sector, your theta alpha has to have square root cuts. So it's going to be antiperiodic when you go around it. Okay, so in order to, of course, in the pure spinifones, we don't have this. So we're going to treat it, we can try to do things in the same way as we do, as Friedan-Martinek-Shankly did for the psis. We're just going to bosonize these and construct spin fields. So bosonizing theta is quite easy. We just write it as e to the I sigma, and P alpha would be e to the minus I sigma. So for each theta, I have a sigma. And now the BRST operator has this structure. And now if you remember what the extra term I had was, which I was throwing away before, so I can rescale the gamma tilde to get rid of the P plus. But I still have this lambda plus here. First of all, you can see from this term, this is, of course, P alpha plus Vx slash theta, you can see that lambda alpha also needs to be antiperiodic. Of the GSO minus sector. So because of the BRST operator, the BRST operator obviously should be periodic. So that means that lambda alpha is also antiperiodic. So let's bosonize that. Again, this is a boson, so we have to bosonize it using this eta. Let's call it phi. So for each, it's not a sum over alpha. For each alpha here, I have an eta and I have a phi. So I need to construct spin fields for this. And now you can see because of this term, B and C, I don't want to have, I don't want to be antiperiodic. But gamma tilde is also going to be antiperiodic. So let me call it eta tilde, eta the phi tilde. So you can see in the GSO plus sector, I could have thrown these away because it's periodic, there's nothing depends on it. But once I do GSO minus sector, it's clear that I can't throw it away anymore because it has to have spin fields built out of the gamma tilde. I'm not trying to map RNS to pure spin, I'm just trying to write down the vertex operator for the tachyon. This, well, this was there from the super, well, either you put it in by hand and say, okay, this is an additional term in Q, or I say, well, it came from some other place and I ignored it in the past, but now I'm not going to ignore it anymore. It's the same as in the super, and you can see that it's not manifestly Lorentz covariant, but it turns out that you can define Lorentz transformations which preserve it. It's U5, yes. So gamma tilde is not the Lorentz scalar. You remember?
Yeah.
What was gamma tilde? So gamma tilde came, you started with a gamma A. And you wrote it as lambda A plus delta A plus gamma tilde. So it's one component of an SOA. So things are going to look messy, but if you ignore this, I don't know any way. So of course, I tried hard. I think other people tried hard too. There's no natural way to write down the tachyon vertex. Okay, so what is the vertex? What is the tachyon vertex operator? So this is, of course, in RNS. Now, what's the most natural thing to write down? So, these are all free fields, left moving free fields. So there's B d bar c plus gamma tilde d bar beta tilde. So you see, if lambda plus, so if I ignored this term, drop b c and beta tilde gamma tilde, I'd be back to the original pure spinoformalism where I know how to do things, at least in GSO plus sector. But GSO minus sector, this is the only way I know how to do it. If you want, you can say you're adding, or if you want, you can say, well, you could ignore them. So let me go back to RNS, just to give you a reminder of how it works in RNS. Before Friedan, Martin, and Schenker, nobody cared about the beta-gamma group. So people said, well, you know, the action is dx d bar x plus psi d bar psi. And OK, maybe some people mentioned b d bar c. But to write vertex operators, nobody cared about the beta-gamma. They just said, well, you know, this goes decoupled. And then Friedan, Martin, and Schenker said, well, so then people said, well, how do you write the vertex operator for the Ramon field? And Friedan, Martin, and Schenker were the first ones to realize these beta gammas play a crucial role. If you forgot about them, you can't do it. You know, they had this thing spin 5/8 from the psi's. You need some spin 3/8. And that's where all this polarization gain came from. So there's something similar, I believe, happening in pure spin. Oh, so you have B d bar c plus beta tilde d bar gamma tilde. Okay, so it's a little complicated. It turns out that the Lorentz transformations close up to something which is BRST trivial. But once you introduce these, the Lorentz transformations do not close off shell. The Lorentz algebra only closes up to something which is BRST trivial. It's somewhat similar if you're doing RNS. The space-time supersymmetry algebra only closes up to something which is BRST trivial. So in RNS, you know, you're working in the wrong picture if you want space-time supersymmetry. So space-time supersymmetry only closes up to something which is optional. If you try to force to use GSO minus sector in this, you'll find something similar for the Lorentz transformation. But they only close up to something. So of course, who cares? You could throw away GSO minus and never discuss this. But somebody may ask you, well, where's the tachyon? So of course, unlike in RNS, the intermediate states in RNS, of course, involve Ramon sector. Here, the intermediate states don't involve GSO minus, so you really don't need them unless somebody asks you. Yes. No, this is you. So okay, I didn't say this. It's good you mentioned. So when I discussed these things in the superparticle, I said I started with SO8 invoked to U4. It turns out you can extend that and make the U5 manifest. Oh, okay. So this gamma tilde transforms as a singlet under the U5, under the SU5. Okay, so this is U5 in there. And just to remind you, if you try to write the vertex operator for the Ramon state in RNS using spin fields, the sigma alpha, I guess I already erased them, you also break to U5. So there's something there about U5 that it's the maximal subgroup you can make manifest once you want to introduce this extra sector. So somehow space-time supersymmetry gets exchanged with Lorentz, and GSO minus gets exchanged with Ramon. So only if you work with GSO minus 6. Yeah, if you ignore the, so as I said, if nobody asks you where's the GSO minus, you could ignore it. If you compute GSO plus scattering amplitude, which is the only thing 99.99% of the people want to compute, then I can ignore your question. But some people ask you, well, what about GSO minus scattering? And okay, so then you have to. Okay. So if you want to include everything, life is difficult. I'm just telling you. It might be useful at some point to know how to do GSO minus in a covariant way in Green Schwarz. It's as covariant as it can be. In the same way as RNS is not space-time supersymmetric. Of course, it is space-time supersymmetric, but it's not space-time supersymmetric in a manifest way. Look, Friedan, Martinik, Schenker wrote a paper called Covariant Superstring Quantization, in which space-time supersymmetry was not manifest. Okay, but the fields transformed covariant. It was not like Kohn gauge. This is not like Kohn gauge. I can do this in like Kohn gauge, break conformal invariance, and then it's trivial. Not trivial, but you have spin fields, but you obviously don't have lambdas. The problem is you want to do things in a way that preserves conformal invariance, and it's covariant in the sense that the Lorentz transformations close up to something which is, in the same way as RNS is space-time supersymmetric, this is covariant. Now, I'm not saying this because I'm proud of this. I'm saying this because somebody may ask you at some point, well, where's the tachyon? So, and obviously, it's telling you something about this thing, which may be something very deep, but OK. I obviously don't have a nice way to say it, otherwise I would say it. OK, so anyway, what's the tachyon? OK, so what's the simplest thing you can do? Well, it's clear that the thetas, if you compare with this case, so this was e to the phi over 2 sigma alpha, you want it to have square root zeros with the tachyon vertex up here. So that means you're going to have e to the I sigma alpha over 2. Each of these, so of course for each alpha you have one of them. So you have 16 of these, each one contributes minus 1/8. I get minus 16. So theta, of course, carries conformal weight 0. This turns out to be the thing of lowest conformal weight you can construct. So it has, each one has minus 1/8. Now, from the lambdas, not surprisingly, it's going to have the opposite structure. So it will be e to the minus phi over 2. Sorry, this phi is not the same as this phi. Maybe I should erase it. You have 11 of these. It turns out that each lambda essentially cancels one of the thetas. So you get plus 11/8 from here. And then finally, you have the gamma tilde. Now, gamma tilde has conformal weight minus 1. Because this has conformal weight 2, this has conformal weight minus 1. It turns out that gamma tilde, if you try to compare this with RNS, this term here plays the same role as beta as b gamma squared. So gamma tilde lambda plus is really trying to be gamma squared in the RNS form. Now this has a, if you remember the vertex operator, this was c e to the minus phi. This has a term eta prime e to the 2 phi. This has a double zero. So what you find is that the term you need from the gamma tilde is e to the, like, so this is supposed to be the vertex operator, and this contributes conformal weight 9/8. So you can see the coefficient here is actually related to the conformal weight of these objects, so or actually the screening charge of these objects. So this is minus 1, which means it has screening charge 3. That's why you get the 3/2 here. So this is the maximal. Okay, so if you put an arbitrary coefficient here, you would find that this is the maximal conformal weight you can get from these. And this is the minimal conformal weight you can get from these. And if you add these up, you better get the right answer. So it's minus 5/8 plus 4/8 minus 1/8. So this is minus 1/2. So that's what you want for the tachyon. And you can show that if you take the OP of it with itself, it has the right structure, etc. So this is the text operator in a certain picture. Now, why do I say in a certain picture? Because obviously you should be able to now compute the amplitude involving the tachyons. And if you just compute, for example, two tachyons and a vector, you'll see, obviously, it has the wrong, it doesn't give you lambda, lambda, lambda. So if I use this kind of norm, it doesn't make sense because you only have one lambda here. These t's are going to give you, when you multiply two of these together, you'll get e to the minus phi's for each of the lambdas. So it doesn't look anything like this. In order to get it to look like this, you have to hit with picture changing. So for each of these bosonizations, I can define picture changing. So I have a C for each of these. So you need a bunch of picture changing things to get it up to here. So I don't remember, I think it's E to the 11th or something like that. So you can see that as soon as you go to the GSO minus sector, all of the nice features look terrible. Just like when you do RNS, when you try to work in the Ramon sector, all of the nice properties, n equals 1 superconformal invariance, becomes a mess. Okay, so that's GSO minus sectors. Okay, so in the last 5 minutes, let me just try to connect with some of the things that Barton said about string field theory. Okay, so I mentioned already for the superparticle that formally you can write this action. Okay, so what about for the string? So the first thing we have to do is remember that there's a regularization factor. So if I really want to use this is my norm, it's clear this norm is degenerate. There are certain states here which don't have a dual, because obviously, if I have a state with more than three lambdas, there's no dual. If I have a state with more than five thetas, there's no dual. So in order to describe this in a way in which the norm is non-degenerate, so in order to get equations of motion out, you can't use this norm because it's degenerate. So you have to go back to this non-minimal formalism. So what I want to do is now get this. So as I said already, Pierre will talk about this. So if I define the norm of F be this integral here, and I include the regularization factor, so n was then this norm is non-degenerate, where these f's now can depend not just on x and theta and lambda, but also on lambda bar and r. So I'll assume that they're polynomials in lambda bar and r. And now this functional integration is perfectly non-degenerate. So using this definition, where now my string field, instead of just depending on x theta and lambda, depends on all these fields, now I can use this action to get equations of motion in the usual way. The only thing is that I have to remember there's an n here. Rho is a constant. Yes. Okay. So this is, of course, Q of something. Where now Q is the so if these were all BRST closed, it would not depend on rho. But of course, I want to do off shell, so it does depend on rho. So this is actually a function which depends on rho. So this depends on rho. And in principle, eta, sorry? What value is what? N, yes? I put it at the midpoint. I'll get there. Okay, so I'll get there now, just because. So if you've seen any of these constructions that Barton had the good sense not to talk about, so these string field theory actions where you have different pictures, what they do is they put an operator here. So because if you choose this operator to have a certain picture, then you can change the picture of these. Now the equation of motion you get from here is of course not q phi plus phi squared equals zero. It's n times. So somebody had a question. In the construction of Freitrop, Thorne, Yost, and then RFF, et cetera, this n is not invertible. So this was a y, and this y had a kernel. So it was not invertible. There are certain states in which when you act on it, it gives you zero. This n is obviously invertible. So n inverse, you just e to the plus rho. I don't think there's a limit. So here you can obviously take rho to infinity, in which this becomes 1. I don't think there's such a similar limit for them. Yeah? It's related. Yeah. Look, all I can say is, in their operator, there's no parameter you can set. You can fiddle with. If there was, maybe you can fix what they did. I don't know. Okay, so this doesn't cause a problem because, of course, this implies. Okay, but as Martin already pointed out, this is an action which depends on rho. So you can expand it. It turns out to have a term. It's, of course, when rho goes to 0, this goes away. So it's clear that it has to be singular when rho goes to 0. So you have terms depending on. So it has an infinite number of terms depending on rho, but string field theory has an infinite number of terms. So in principle, I don't see any problem with using this to do open superstring field theory. Now, there's a problem when you try to gauge fix it. Because when you gauge fix it, you're going to have to introduce the B ghost. And the B ghost, as I mentioned here, has poles. So once you introduce poles, the Hilbert, you can't restrict phi to be polynomials. Because the poles change polynomials into things with poles. So then I don't know what to do. Now, if you want to do closed string field theory, obviously you need the B ghost. So I don't know a version of this for closed string field theory. But there's one thing I'll finish with, which, so this is kind of advertisement for a recent paper here. Okay, so you can look at this N term. Okay, look at N, okay? Just look at it, that you can do it. And now you rescale R and lambda bar. So suppose I redefine R prime equals rho R and lambda prime equal rho lambda bar prime. And obviously, the conjugate momentum I scale in the opposite way, I can remove this rho dependence. So because the fields are polynomials in the R's, then just by reading off, you can write phi. If you like, you can take all the rho dependence out of N and put it into the phi. And then it's easy to see that it just depends on inverse powers. Mm-hmm. No, because when you do this rescaling, as long as it's polynomials in the R's, if there were inverse powers of the R's or lambda bars, yes. But because it's polynomial. This is just classical. Okay, so if you want to do closed string field, so this is advertisement for a recent paper I wrote a few, I guess last week. If you do things in ADS 5 times S5, it turns out the B ghost is easier to construct. You don't need to construct non-minimal fields. Okay, now I think Barton already mentioned, for type 2B, if you work in a flat background, there's no hope. At least there's little hope, just because we know already in the massless limit we're going to have problems with the self-dual phi form if you try to do a covariant. Now, if you try to write the effective action ADS 5 times S5, I think there's no problem in writing the action in a way that preserves all the PSU 224 or something. So this is a conjecture. I mean, it certainly hasn't been done yet. But I think I think there will be a way to write the effective action in a way which preserves all the PSU 224 isometries, and I think these problems with the B ghost may go away when you're working in the ADS 5 background. So that's something that I discussed in a recent paper. But in some sense, the ADS 5 times S5 acts as a regulator, where the radius plays the role of this rho parameter. So there's a hope, I would say, of writing closed superstring field theory in this ADS 5 times S5 background. Okay, so I'll stop. Eta, n. So n is, because n is BRST closed, so it's q with n is 0, it doesn't, I mean, it's clear that the equation of motion is gauge invariant. So, yes, so it will be gauge invariant. For the same reason as the Breitschoff, Thorn, Yost thing is gauge invariant. Well, actually, what you'll find is that the usual Yang-Mills fields will all sit in S0. This will have the F squared and the, but some of the auxiliary fields will only become auxiliary after integrating out the Lagrange multipliers coming from S1. So it's kind of subtle how things work, but almost everything, all the cubic vertices and everything are obviously in here, because those are the ones that, when you go on, shall survive. It looks vaguely like harmonic space in the sense of, you know, you have this extra bosonic parameter. Yeah. Yeah. Off shell. Off shell will depend on rho. On shell, everything will go away. All the rho dependence will go away. So they're polynomial. So I should say this, I forgot to mention, this is in a paper. So I also forgot to say, many features of these non-minimal fields was worked out together with Nikita Nekrasov. So he will talk about some other things when he comes. But so this action was discussed in... So the question was, how does this depend? So it's a polynomial. You know, all the lambdas and x's and thetas and r's and lambda bars, etc. You're asking about the NMN? That's what you're asking about? So, yeah. So if I start to allow poles, then I need to be careful. So the poles can only go, it turns out, up to order 11. But obviously, if everything is polynomial, I'll never have poles. So if I just want to analyze the classical action, and I'm not trying to do gauge fixing, then I can treat everything as polynomials, and I think there's no problem. Yes. So they're almost like BF terms or something like that.